This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hszc.org.
Morning, everybody.
Morning.
Morning.
My name is Reverend Hokai, or also Max, and I wanted to speak about mindfulness today. I started leading a mindfulness group here Monday night, Monday Mindfulness with Max, and it's been going on for a few weeks. Richard's been there a couple times, and I also teach mindfulness where I work, the hospital, to patients, and I don't know if I teach it, I lead them in mindfulness to help them with their anxiety. I also do teach the neurology residents, which is always interesting. So I wanted to start with a psalm, which does mention God, so if that's offensive to you, just, you know, you can think of it as something else, Buddha or the universe. But Psalm 46:10 says, "Be still and know that I am God." And one of my Christian colleagues told me that there's a way to use that little piece as a meditation by taking that "Be still and know that I am God," and then you drop off a word each time. So then, "Be still and know that I am." "Be still and know that I," etc., down to "Be still," which to me feels like meditation, to be still. And that's what we do here. We sit in stillness. And sitting in stillness to me does not mean spacing out, although naturally my mind, when I sit down, gives me lots of opportunities to come back to the present moment. And I feel like looking at the mind that way, when I look at my mind as, okay, there's a thought, there's a worry, and then noticing that and coming back to the present is flexing that muscle. And doing that again and again, like learning to ride a bike, eventually I've noticed that my mind will settle and learn to come back to the present. Not always. Often I sit down and it's wild, or I'm worried or caught up in some story, which, as the Buddha says, causes us more suffering. If we can be present with our experience, fully present, we will have less suffering. Often when I have pain, I don't like it, and I wonder when it'll end or why it came, or I have a lot of thoughts around it, which is a lot of resistance. I've noticed when I'm able to actually open to the pain, notice the sensations of pain, be with the pain, it's just pain. And it's not suffering anymore. And this is what I believe the Buddha was talking about. I believe the Buddha was saying, there is pain in this world, but there doesn't have to be suffering. We can open to our experience, no matter what it is, and be with it, and train ourselves to be with it, and thus not suffer. Now, I'm not saying that that's an easy practice. It definitely is not. If you're anything like me, you don't like pain and you like pleasure. But as the Buddha said, we will meet that which we don't like, and we will also be separated from that which we do. Anything that we attach to in this world will end, and we will be separated from it. Sorry, realizing this doesn't sound that uplifting, but it's true. So looking at scripture, in the long discourses of Buddha, we have this very famous sutta called the Maha Satipatthana Sutta, which is the Maha meaning great, greater discourse on the foundations of mindfulness. And the Buddha starts out with contemplation of the body and breathing. And he says, and how monks, this could also be practitioners, how does a practitioner abide contemplating the body as body? Here a practitioner, having gone into the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty place, sits down cross-legged, holding his body erect, having established mindfulness before him. Mindfully he breathes in, mindfully he breathes out. Breathing in a long breath, he knows that he breathes in a long breath. And breathing out a long breath, he knows that he breathes out a long breath. Breathing in a short breath, he knows that he breathes in a short breath. And breathing out a short breath, he knows that he breathes out a short breath. He trains himself thinking, I will breathe in, conscious of the whole body. He trains himself thinking, I will breathe out, conscious of the whole body. He trains himself thinking, I will breathe in, calming the whole body process. He trains himself thinking, I will breathe out, calming the whole body process. So that's where we start with mindfulness, with the sitting down and breathing and knowing our breath, knowing our thoughts, and noting our thoughts. When I studied Vipassana, that's what they taught me, to note things. So I recommend this practice. If you have a lot of thought, you can always just note thinking or sensation. Looking at yourself like a scientist. And this way, not getting too involved in the actual thoughts. Thinking. Notice, and then come back to the breathing, noticing if the breath is long, the breath is short. Becoming interested in your experience. What we normally would think of as maybe quite boring can become quite interesting. No guarantees. So I don't know if I'm necessarily recommending this during the practice of Zazen. I know Zazen is sitting quietly and still, kind of like the psalm says, to just be still. I would recommend it if you are getting lost in your thoughts to remember your breath, remember your body, using your body as an anchor, using the sensations of your body as an anchor rather than the mind. For me, my mind is this way and that, and is not a good anchor. But my body is stable and on its own accord is taking care of me. My heart is beating. My lungs are breathing. Blood is flowing. Food's digesting. And I'm not having to do any of that. It's doing it all on its own. What we do in our mind is our own business. And if you want to suffer, that's your own business. And there is this practice. Back to scripture, the second part of mindfulness is the contemplation of feelings. And how, monks, does a practitioner abide contemplating feeling as feelings? You're a practitioner feeling a pleasant feeling, knows that he feels a pleasant feeling. Feeling a painful feeling, he knows that he feels a painful feeling. Feeling a feeling that is neither painful nor pleasant, he knows that he feels a feeling that is neither painful nor pleasant. Feeling a pleasant sensual feeling, he knows he feels a pleasant sensual feeling. Feeling a pleasant non-sensual feeling, he knows he feels a pleasant non-sensual feeling. And it goes on. But this is after contemplating the body, you can contemplate feelings. The three types: pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Pleasant and unpleasant are usually, for me, easier to recognize than neutral, but can be equally as important. And the third contemplation is contemplation of mind. And here it says, knowing if you have a lustful mind, you know it as lustful. Or if you're free from lust, you notice that too. And I bring that up because in terms of talking about neutrality, it's also helpful to notice, for example, a hating mind is hating, but a mind free from hate as well. So even though we do have these various visitors of the mind in our mind of greed, hate, and delusion, they also do pass like clouds in the sky. And are just one part of the whole picture. So noticing feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and noticing mind, noticing hate, lust, anything arising in the mind as mind objects, and just noting that is mindfulness. And noting when they are absent as well. Noticing if you lean into something pleasant or push away from something unpleasant, can you be upright in the middle of your life? Can you be upright in the middle of your zazen and be mindful of your experience? Realizing that there's nowhere to go. nothing to do and no one to be. Just noticing our experience. Being mindful of our experience. Notice the visitors of the mind. And notice the absence of the visitors of the mind. Impermanent. Everything that arises persists and then passes away. Fourth contemplation of mindfulness is the mindfulness of dharmas, or mind objects, which is a little more complicated for me because it seems like the Buddha or whoever put this together added a few different things. For example, the five hindrances, the five aggregates, and the four noble truths. The five hindrances being for example, sensual desire. A monk notices if it's present or absent, as we spoke of. Ill will or hate, second hindrance. Sloth and torpor. This says worry and flurry for the fourth, and then flurry. And then doubt. Noticing those and coming back to the present, if those arise in your mind, again, is mindfulness. If lust arises during your meditation, it's not particularly helpful in your meditation. Notice that, and again, ground in the body. Ill will comes up, hatred. Again, notice grounding in the body, in the present moment. If you're tired, sloth, torpor arises. Again, another mind object to notice. And watch. Worry, obsessive worry and flurry, I like that. Again, another object to notice. And then doubt, even if it's very persistent, another object to notice. As I understand the story of the Buddha, he was tempted by this figure Mara. Who actually reminds me a little bit of these hindrances, these arisings that happen in the mind that may appear annoying but actually are helpful for us. Like I said, another opportunity to come back to our present state. Like the Buddha, to smile at these arrows coming at us, to bring love to these arrows of hatred, and greed and ignorance, to melt those arrows with your love. And to hold those hindrances as part of yourself, as your teachers. If you had no hindrances, you would not get strong. So contemplation of the body, the sensations, the breathing, contemplation of the feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Contemplation of the mind, what's arising in the mind. Then contemplation of the five hindrances. Also in the fourth, contemplation of the seven factors of enlightenment and the five aggregates as well. And the four noble truths. Suffering and the end of suffering. And why do we suffer? I think I mentioned before, just the resistance to our, this is my point of view, but I think the Buddha would agree, the resistance to our experience. Wanting that which is pleasant, not liking that which is unpleasant. Meeting that which we don't like and being separated from that which we do. Of course, sickness, old age, and death, which none of us can escape. Before working in the hospital, I thought, I had some weird thought that maybe everybody lived till 85 or something, but the truth is I've seen many people die of all ages, including children. Death is certain, and time of death is uncertain. We must really be present with our experience now, because this is what we have, only this moment, and now it's gone. An old age is coming, or has come maybe for some of us, I don't know. Again, I feel like this is getting very heavy. So I wanted to read a poem by Philip Whalen, because we mentioned him today. He was the abbot here. I don't know if this has anything to do with what I'm talking about, but it was a poem that Philip Whalen wrote at Tassajara in August 11th, 1977. It's called Back to Normalcy. My ear stretches out across limitless space and time to meet the fly's feet coming to walk on it. The cat opens an eye and shuts it. That much meaning, use, or significance. Wind chime, hawk's cry, pounding metal generator, bell and board rehearsing blue jays. Dana, phoning, shouts, you mean fiberglass? Telephone, grape leaves, shaped together. Dull blonde sycamore sunshine, Dana says, all you guys bliss out behind the carrot and raisin salad. Brown, dumb leaves fall on bright ferns. New and thick, sense the fire. And back to our experience. Noticing our body, our breathing. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral mind states. And so I think it's important to note, though, despite all that maybe heavy stuff I did say, despite the fact that there is suffering, there is the end of suffering, as the Buddha said, contemplating the dharmas and the fourth noble truth, that we do suffer when we resist our lives, but that we can open, we can practice, and we can train ourselves to be open, to to our lives. It does not mean you will not confront pain, but maybe you'll have some more ease in your life with whatever arises. So, the first truth being suffering, the second, why we suffer, our desire for the good, our hate of what we don't like, and our not noticing that which we don't see it. And then the third truth of the end of suffering, the opening to our experience, and then the fourth truth of getting there through the Noble Eightfold Path. And what, monks, is the noble truth, the way of practice leading to the cessation of suffering? It is this Noble Eightfold Path, namely, right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. So following this Eightfold Path, to open to our lives, to take refuge in our community, our Sangha, the teachings of the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. The teachings of the Buddha is Dharma, the Sangha, the community, and the actual, I guess that would be refuge in the actual Buddha, the Buddha that is. That's how I see mindfulness. Mindfulness being the practice of opening to our lives, to train ourselves to be with our experience, to be present. And with that training, to end our suffering. It's worth a try, right? Questions, comments, anything? Sir?
Wondering when, how you, what you thought about reconciling mindfulness with Zazen. You know, sort of like, if you got to ask that.
It's a good question.
Because I mean, it's something I sort of circle around and I'm just curious
your
thoughts on it.
So I feel that they are two different trainings. But I don't feel that, I feel like Zazen for me, when I'm saying Zazen, I'm talking about the little Zazen of sitting here, not the, mm-hmm. the big Zazen that I have no ideas. The little Zazen sitting is allowing the mind to settle, whereas practicing Vipassana is actively trying to bring the mind back. And I'm not sure if it's probably not recommended to do that. Is that right, Mio? Is that not recommended in the Zendo to do mindfulness? Come back to practice that.
I have a different point of view.
Okay, what's your point of view? He's the expert.
Zazen, properly understood, basically includes mindfulness.
Okay.
These structured practices from Vipassana or something else again. So.
Okay.
But that sounds like two different practices, as you were mentioning. As you were
the way
saying.
That's my limited understanding of Zazen. Yeah, so I see them as two different. But, yeah. Yes.
In your own experience regarding how people accept mindfulness instruction. Do you think that most of them really get it, or are they more apt to just look for some type of distraction in the course of dealing with things?
You mean, do they want to practice mindfulness, or?
Well, I mean, I assume that many people are already accustomed to dealing with suffering by distraction or
right.
something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you speak of resistance, is distraction part of their resistance?
Yes.
Yes.
I see it that way, yes. So it's kind of resistance to the experience, because you don't want to be with the experience.
Right.
Yeah.
And does it take a while? I mean, when you advance the idea of not just moving towards distraction as a way of putting things
mm-hmm.
aside, do you find that initially the idea of putting distractions aside to be quite a hurdle, or
mm-hmm.
do people really get what you're saying, that just trying to put it aside with distractions just won't work?
I think everyone's different, but I think that it's hard if you're used to distracting yourself. Like a lot of us are taught in this culture, it's very hard to give that up. And you see that if you go on a retreat for a long time, you don't have any of those distractions. It's, see how addicted we are. I am. I saw how addicted I was to my phone or to whatever little distractions. And so I think it is. It's like I personally know that I can become addicted to, or have been or am addicted to a distraction. So it's like giving up any other addiction. It's very difficult. So I don't think it's an easy sell.
All right.
Yeah. And then you have to titrate. You have to do a little bit at once. Yeah.
Would you consider reading a distraction? If you're able to read.
I guess it depends on the reading. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it depends on... So if you're reading something like this, it's probably not a distraction. I don't know. But
right.
if you're reading science fiction, maybe it's a distraction. But maybe that's okay. I mean, it's like when people have grief, like when this experience happens and someone has grief, they can't usually have all the grief at once. Their mind titrates the grief, maybe their denial in the beginning. And that's the way that we deal with it. So I think that in my point of view, in terms of the path of giving up distractions, it's a step-by-step process
mm-hmm.
and different for every person. And not easy. Do you like to read?
I like to read, and I just think it's a great way to get away from things. So,
uh-huh.
Do you find, do many people read, I mean, if they're still able enough to focus.
Mm-hmm. Are you talking about patients? Is that
right, patients.
I mean, there's a TV in every patient's room, so that's one distraction. Sometimes they can't read because they just can't. And I mean, I think there's probably a time and a place for distraction as well. Like I'm saying, but if you're over, like just using it, if you notice in your experience, something you have to know with your wisdom, if your stuff's coming up for you and you're like, oh, I want to read the science fiction, and you keep going to that and you keep going to that. Or if you're like, it's an hour before bed, I want to read science. I mean, it's just different. So you would only know for yourself. But I do think that's answering to your question. It is a tough sell, but usually when I'm sitting with people in the hospital and doing or practicing mindfulness, they usually like it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't had anyone not like that. And they find it hard to do it by themselves. I think Mio had a question, and I'll get to you.
So, yeah, I just wanted to clarify the second foundation of mindfulness. To use the English word, feelings is typically confusing for people.
Okay.
So to call it sensation focuses much more clearly on what Buddha seems to have been talking about.
Pleasant or unpleasant, neutral.
Yeah.
I don't know why. Well, this is Bhikkhu Bodhi? No.
Maurice Walsh.
Yeah, translated as feelings. So.
Yeah, I think that's not
sensations.
Called.
Okay.
Sensations.
Okay, thank you. What's the Pali?
Vedana.
Which is sensation. Okay. Yes, sir. Oh, I thought you had a question.
When you have too many things to do, when you're really busy, I see it is very easy to sort of let go of the practice, and also hold the mindfulness. So when you're really running around getting things done, it's hard to like savor every grain of rice like it's your last.
Which it might be, right?
So, yeah. Do you have any actual like tips or like skills for dealing with that?
Well, I mean, yeah. So I work with the doctors too, and I can't seem to get them to slow down, and they have a zillion things in their brains. And one thing, when we go into a room, we always gel like hand gel. So I try to stop that, so you're not gelling and running in. You're in tech, right? So. Can you put something on your computer to ding every half hour so you can take a breath or two? Can you, something to ding and then you can stand up? We'd have to sit down and look at your whole schedule, but I think you could put time in there. Do you know what I'm saying? You just don't feel like you could even sandwich like a little tiny something in there like even taking one or two breaths or coming. Imagine doing that throughout your day. I think there are apps on the computer that do that. Or you set a timer. That's one idea. Do you have any ideas of, you just feel way, way overloaded with work?
Yeah.
Quit your job. And go to the mountains and sit quietly under a tree. Like the Buddha did. Yes, sir.
What would you say would be the difference between trying to find some sort of momentary stillness in the midst of your frantically busy life?
Mm-hmm.
However that may manifest, whether you're a doctor or whatever, and just completely doing your life, just completely throwing yourself into your activity completely, and don't hold back.
Mm-hmm.
And then that you run the risk, I think, of burning yourself out. When we were running hospice, we saw that quite frequently.
Mm-hmm.
People that were just totally engaged.
Okay.
In the activity of assisting sick and dying people in many different ways.
Okay.
And they kept doing it and doing it and doing it. Which is sort of great on one hand, and yet maybe they didn't pause enough. I'm just questioning that sort of the dynamic between busyness and stillness and how they...
Yeah.
Work together.
Yeah, I don't know the answer. I mean, I think especially in something like hospice work, it's great that they're engaged that way, but also taking a moment every now and then to take a breath or to do some kind of self-care. If you don't, you're going to burn out. That's what I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're pointing to? Or is you're pointing to that, because I had mentioned to Delib to like have a break, you're saying, but he might be totally engaged in his life and that's complete mindfulness in that way, or
it's like it's not like there's anything wrong with being busy per se.
Yeah,
right? Sometimes we have to be busy,
okay,
because there are things to do and there are important things.
Okay,
so
when you're busy, just be busy.
Just be busy. Yeah.
Okay. Sure.
But then you do probably need to take a breath at some point.
Take a breath. Yeah. I would say so.
Give yourself a little.
Yeah.
Just for me.
But I like that. I mean, that's like Tassajara practice, Zen practice, right? To be completely engaged with what you're doing.
Well, that's how I see it.
Yeah, okay. That sounds good to me. Yes, sir.
I wanted to put out a slightly different perspective on the hindrances, where I feel like, they come up and you see that they're an obstacle to practice, but I think sometimes they can kind of be like alarm bells where there's something going on in your life that needs attending to, and that's why they're coming up. maybe you're really worried because there's a legitimate concern in your life that you need to take care of. And when you take care of it, the worrying is going to stop. Or maybe there's a torpor because you're really not getting good sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like an alarm bell telling you, hey, something's going on here. You're not sleeping well. You need to take care of it. Or with any of them, I think. It seems like a balancing act because I know, you know, the Buddha didn't advocate austerities in practice. You know, he tried that and it didn't work for him. So it's like, I mean, there's a difference between sensual pleasure, like, oh, I need to go out and, like, you know, shoot up some heroin or something to make me feel better. And like, oh, you know, my body is telling me I need to eat some healthy food and drink some water and take care of my body. It's like your body isn't the enemy, and maybe it's giving off signals that you need to take care of something in your life. At least I've had that experience with the hindrances, that it's like they're coming up. It's not necessarily just something to ignore. They may be calling your attention to something in your life that you need to take care of.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that in sitting. I personally found sitting practice that that can often be quite helpful and nourishing, that something's coming up and I recognize that there's a problem that I need to take care of. And maybe if I wasn't sitting, I wouldn't even notice, you know? I would just be spinning my gears and upset and not even really understand why.
I think, like, the example, like, for example, sloth and torpor, if your body is tired, your body's tired.
Yeah.
That's coming from the body.
Yeah.
What I'm talking about is from the mind, that sloth of the mind, which is a meditative hindrance.
Right, right.
And, right, or, like, for example, lust. Like, maybe there's a time for lust not on the cushion, but if you're on the cushion, it's not really that helpful, right? So it's, like, a thing to be aware of.
But I think sometimes it can arise, like, in response to that you're not taking care of yourself adequately as well. I mean, yeah, there's like a torpor of the mind and you aren't focused and that's something to be aware of and take care of or whatnot. But
what would be an example? Can you give me an example of that?
Well, like I said, like with the worrying, say I'm noticing a lot of worrying.
Okay.
I think that
there's something that needs to get done.
In sitting, oftentimes it seems to come a lot more clear of what's wrong and what actually needs. I mean, I think that sitting can be a window, a guide, or practice can be a guide also, not just for like pure introversion,
okay,
but for something that you actually need to take care of in your life.
Okay.
So
like
if I'm worrying a lot about something, maybe it's because there's actually a legitimate concern underneath. Like worrying isn't helpful. Like I'm definitely prone to worry.
Okay.
But usually I found that I'll stop worrying if I notice what's wrong and I take care of it.
Oh, I see. So, like, let's say you're worrying and you actually literally have a paper. It's like you're sitting meditation at 6 p.m. on Sunday, but you know you have a paper due the next day.
That's an example. You know,
okay.
It's like maybe it's just that there's something.
Okay, so you know you need to do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or it could be, you know, it could be more subtle than that, or it could be something, you know.
But for that time, like, let's say it's 6 to 6:40, can you say, okay, no, this is what I would say for the mindfulness, is you know, okay, worry. And I'm going to get to that at 6:40.
Well, yeah.
You see what I'm saying? So then you can actually, you know, be in that period. Or you can notice, or if the worry keeps coming up, notice it.
I'm just saying that, like, if you're worrying and worrying, like, what I think that part of the skillfulness and mindfulness is saying maybe there's something that needs to be taken care of, not just like, oh, I'm worrying and I need to label that and not do anything about it. You know what I mean? Like, oh, there's doubt, so I need to notice the doubt but not do anything about it. Or, oh, I'm thirsty. I need to notice that I'm thirsty, but not do anything about it. I think that's a problem. I don't think that's helpful. You know, I mean, it's kind of on a continuum. You know, it's like, it's not that there can't be unhealthy doubt and unhealthy worry, but sometimes those things are arising as part of a legitimate need that needs to be addressed, or a concern that needs to be taken care of. I mean, I've made that mistake myself.
Okay.
In mindfulness practice, just kind of like thinking that.
I think. Do you want to say something to that, or?
Kind of.
Okay, go ahead.
Again, I don't like I'm quibbling with Morris Walsh's translations.
Okay.
we're talking specifically about skeptical doubt.
Okay. Yes.
Not
of course. Yeah.
Any doubt.
Yeah. Skeptical doubt.
Corrosive doubt.
Yeah. Corrosive
and
doubt.
And also the fourth hindrance, I think, is also being mistranslated.
Which the.
worry and flurry?
Oh yeah, worry and flurry. I've never. Well, that's the first time I've seen that. Yeah, I don't. What is it normally? It's normally.
It's very British sounding.
What it's.
Bhatya kalkritya, it conjures in my mind excitedness and or agitation and regret.
Agitation and regret. Okay. Yeah, worry.
Yeah, I don't know where he gets flurry. Because the Sanskrit word kalkritya refers to misdeeds.
Okay.
So to be, you know, kind of agitated and constantly the mind going back to misdeeds and things like that.
Oh, right. Okay.
That's more like that hindrance.
Right.
And again, sometimes, as Jonathan says, there may be something that needs to be dealt with there. This is where maybe therapy comes in the West. You don't get that in the Asian tradition.
Oh, okay.
So, being Westerners, we have a somewhat different perspective on that, I think, by necessity.
Uh-huh. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, it's also sort of wisdom, as there's a point where you understand what needs to be followed through on and what doesn't need to be followed through
right.
on, or what is a hindrance and what is something real that you need to address in your life.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's what I would say, John. I mean, that's a good, like, just the, I mean, yeah, if you got to pee, go pee. Or you got to drink some water, that's your body telling you something.
Yeah.
But if you're, the sleepy one's tricky, I think.
Well, I mean, I know, I've noticed for myself that, like, you know, I can, that's something that can be something that I can really struggle with. But oftentimes, in practice, and I mean, it may be challenging, but I'll notice that it's, practice can seem to point me in the direction of what I need to do. Take care of that so that I have more energy. Maybe that I really do need more rest and I get that rest, or you know, maybe that there's something that's been bothering me and I need to talk to somebody about it, and then once I do, I feel 100% better. Or I don't know, it's just
what I'm hearing you say is that when you sit quietly, you hear your more of your inner voice telling you what you need, and that's beautiful. I think that's great. Yeah,
and it's pretty clear. I think that oftentimes a therapist isn't needed. I mean, it's the most clear.
It's your inner guide,
and it's your body is letting you know as well. It's not just your mind. It's not just your mind that can go around in circles and around in circles. It's something that's a lot clearer. It's something that's like, I don't know. That's.
Mm-hmm. That sounds good.
Maybe just one more question.
Okay.
Someone has
one. Okay. Yes, sir.
Since there was a space there, I thought I would bring up this question that I had doubts about. In talking about neutral feelings and neutral sensations, I was trying to find an example for myself, and might the effect of sitting be that neutral sensation?
Is sitting neutral?
Yeah, because I'm not feeling elated, I'm not feeling angry, or hopefully none of, I'm sorting through those type of feelings just to be in the moment, which is just kind of neutral.
At that moment, it sounds neutral. I mean, it sounds neutral. Usually neutral we don't notice. Like, it sounds like now you're noticing that might be neutral.
That's what I'm asking.
Like, you're not having a great experience, you're not having an unpleasant experience. That sounds pretty neutral.
Yeah.
And then, so what my point of view, other people might disagree, is you could, in your meditation, become really interested in that neutral. Because people usually aren't. We usually kind of just tune that out. It's kind of, it goes in like the sort of ignorance category. You know, like pleasure is sort of in the greed category and pain sort of in the hate, and this would be in the more diluted category where we just don't notice. Does that make sense?
Like diluted or diluted?
Diluted.
Neutral is, I'm missing a point.
Okay, maybe I'm making it worse. All I'm saying is my recommendation is become interested in it. And that would be are you interested in when you're neutral, or are you spacing out? What is your experience?
I'm just trying to find a good solid example of what neutral is.
Okay.
And what you think that might be.
Oh.
Because we know what the positive and negative examples are. Is there a helpful image of what a neutral state of feeling or sensation might be?
Abbott, you want to say?
Again, we're talking sensation. So don't confuse feelings of, you know, agitation or desire. Those don't count. So if you rub your two little fingers together very gently, it's like that's kind of like, well, it's not really positive, it's not really negative, it's just a sensation. So that's quite neutral. And if you start attending to those, you may find there are lots of actually neutral sensations happening. And there are others that are, okay, that's disagreeable, or that one's really nice. But these others, they're just, it's a sensation on the body, that's all. So I think that's what's being driven.
Well, thank you. That's helpful.
Okay. Yeah, I don't. This translation, right? Worry and flurry. And was he an Englishman?
Yes.
Oh. Well, anyway, thank you all for being here.